I welcome all of you on behalf of Mohile Parikh Center for the Visual Arts, and I request Geeta Kapoor, who is the chairperson for this session, to introduce Andreas Hussain.
I'm delighted and honored to introduce Andreas Hussain among us today. Professor Hussain is Willard Professor of German and Comparative Literature at Columbia University, New York, since 1986. While he's a specialist in German literature, particularly of the 18th century, 18th to the 20th century, our acquaintance, the acquaintance of many of us, and I think there would be some, very definitely some people in the audience who have read him, our acquaintance comes from the time that he wrote his major book, After the Great Divide, Modernism, Mass Culture, and Postmodernism, which was published in 1986. Some of us had read it quite soon after that, and has been a part of the discussion about these issues since then in the Indian cultural debate as well. His 1995 book of essays, Twilight Memories, Marking Time in a Culture of Amnesia, is just out last year, and I don't think many of us are familiar with it. I wasn't. I've just had a chance to read one essay because I got the book quite recently, which is a seminal essay on Anselm Kiefer, who interests, I think, a lot of the Indian artists. Particularly, I know for a fact that Kiefer interests the younger Kerala artists a lot, and a discussion of that, for example, amongst the younger painters in many of them situated in Baroda would be, I think, of great interest to them. And so we should, I suppose, be getting familiar with that work. I think that the talk today comes out of the kinds of considerations which are in his second book. Very briefly, I would like to mention, which will obviously come through in the talk as well, for those of us who are familiar with the mapping in which Andreas Hussain probably is situated, is that he would take off and be critically engaged with certain key texts, like Peter Berger's Theory of the Avant-Garde, like Jameson's Postmodernism and the Cultural Logic of Late Capitalism. And he would then speak about it in terms which would have parities with several other writers with whom another set of people, for instance, cinema theory is engaged, people like Peter Wallen and Paul Villeman. I mentioned some of these names so that the points of connection with different members of the audience might be immediately made. I think that the kinds of issues that will be raised today and possibly on Sunday would deal with postmodernism. And I've been talking to Andreas, so it seems that one of the issues that would be key to the discussion would be temporality at this juncture, or this disjuncture, historical disjuncture, as it turns into a strange inversion of memory. And he is continuing to be engaged with the question of the institutionalizing of the avant-garde, particularly in the Euro-American context. I might mention at the end that Andreas Hussain is a founding editor of a very important critical theory journal, New German Critique, and in which many of the debates pertaining to the intervention of the German intervention of German theory from the Frankfurt School particularly is engaged. Andreas Hussain.
Thank you very much, Geeta, for a very nice introduction, which makes my work look much broader than it really is. And I would also like to thank the Center for bringing me here, for inviting me to this conference, from which I've already learned quite a bit of new stuff regarding debates in this country about issues that have occupied me over a long period of time. However, I will not tonight speak about postmodernism. I will rather address an aesthetic and political category, the category of the monumental, which was as much hated by the modernists as it is today by the postmodernists. So if anything, my topic will draw the two camps together. A few more explanatory notes may perhaps be in order so as to avoid potential misunderstandings of my title, Monumental Seduction. This paper resulted basically from two impulses. First, there was a task a couple of months ago to contribute to a conference on Richard Wagner and the consequences, which was held at Columbia University in New York. And surely monumentality and seduction have been recognized as key to Wagner's work ever since Nietzsche's attack on him. Secondly, however, and more long-term, it was this question of monumentality itself that has been in the back of my mind since I did some work on Anselm Kiefer's paintings and installations, which addressed the image worlds of German fascism and thus broke a taboo in the German artistic world. And as you may know, hostile reactions to Kiefer, and there were plenty at the time, invariably objected to the monumentality of his canvases, and that argument usually ended any further discussion. And if monumentality in that critical discourse had something to do with sheer size, then it struck me as curious that the huge formats of much abstract and neo-abstract painting never seemed to call forth the same venom. Obviously, there was more at stake than simply size, and that more had to do with a peculiarly German prohibition on images, a prohibition relating to the country's Nazi past. Well, that was all 10 or 15 years ago, and thus I see it as a major irony that Germany, where Kiefer's work was most roundly condemned as proto-fascist, has in the meantime engaged in a monument mania of truly monumental proportions. At a time when a memory boom of unprecedented intensity has gripped contemporary Western culture, and not just Germany, and not only in relation to Holocaust remembrance, and when the monumental is primarily coded in temporal terms, I was tempted to rethink what seemed to me to be the great repressed of this new discourse of monuments, namely the relation between the temporal and the spatial dimension. And time and space, of course, have also played a major role in the debates of the early 1980s about postmodernism itself. And here it was then, while I was trying to prepare to have to say something about Wagner as a non-musicologist, there was a happy coincidence that several events of last summer allowed me to find a frame for these reflections on the monumental. Let me add that the slides that I'll be showing are merely illustrative, and some of them are actually also rather poor quality. But since I'm not an art historian working with slides all the time, I don't even feel the need to apologize for that. I mean, this is the best I could do. So here's my paper. Germany, summer 1995, the fifth anniversary of national unification upon us in early October. The 84th Bayreuth Festival opened in July under the motto Redemption Through Love. An exhibit at Bayreuth's Richard Wagner Museum, subtitled Richard Wagner and Eroticism, accompanied last year's performances of Tannhäuser, Tristan and Isolde, The Ring of the Nibelung and Parsifal, works which, according to the museum's director, represent a very special kind of unity and totality, his words, if approached from the angle of eroticism and love. Friedrich went on to describe eroticism and love as symbols of a counterworld, energizing Wagner's dramatic conceptions of redemption. Bayreuth's need for counterworlds and redemption, it seems, is as strong as ever, but it gains a very specific inflection in 1995. Germany and redemption, 50 years after. The country is in the grip of a relentless monument mania, which may not subside until every square mile has its own monument or memorial site, commemorating, of course, not some counterworld of love, but the one world of organized destruction and genocide, which had adopted Wagner as one of its heroes and prophets. In today's Germany, redemption through memory is the goal. It was particularly striking during the events marking the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II that the discourse of redemption had all but replaced the earlier discourses of restitution and reconciliation. Indeed, the Germans have eagerly appropriated the first part of the old Jewish saying, "The secret of redemption is memory," as a strategy for Holocaust management in the 1990s. And here we could maybe dim the lights now because I would have some slides now. the most flagrant case for this kind of Holocaust management is the plan for a How does this thing turn on? This is not on, is it? Oh, okay, thank you. The most flagrant case for what I'm calling a Holocaust management was the plan for a gigantic Holocaust memorial. This is not the first one. The plan for a gigantic Holocaust memorial, a slanted concrete slab the size of two football fields with millions of victim names carved in stone in the heart of Berlin. This was to be built just north of Hitler's bunker and thus right on top of Albert Speer's, Hitler's master architect's, would-be north-south axis. This is a map of the, you know, the layout north-south. The Brandenburg Gate is up there, and the Holocaust monument was supposed to be built right here on this plan, north-south axis, between the Brandenburg Gate and the Leipziger Platz in the south. So, and I'm saying it was to be built because it looks like public debate and outrage have resulted in a rethinking of the whole project at this point. But anyway, it's still symptomatic enough to talk about here. It was thus to be built right on top of Albert Speer's would-be north-south axis between Speer's megalomaniac Great Hall, which you see there on the upper right, just north of the Reichstag, and Hitler's triumphal arch to the south, which called for the names of the fallen of World War I to be carved in stone. The very site and inscription practice of the prize-winning Holocaust memorial thus appears to function both as mimesis and cover-up of another site memory with the requisite monumentality to match the dimensions of Speer's original plan. Indeed, it seems striking that a country whose culture has been guided for decades now by a deliberate anti-fascist anti-monumentalism should resort to monumental dimensions when it comes to the public commemoration of the Holocaust for a reunified nation. Something here is out of sync. But in another perspective, this embrace of the monumental may not be all that surprising. Recalling the Austrian writer Robert Musil's observation that there is nothing as invisible as a monument, Berlin, and with it all of this memorial-crazed Germany, is simply opting for invisibility. The more monuments there are, the more the past becomes invisible, the easier it is to forget. Redemption thus through forgetting. Indeed, many critics describe Germany's current obsession with monuments and memorials as the not-so-subtle attempt at a disposal of radiating historical waste. Monumental invisibility, at any rate, was at stake during another major cultural event this past summer in Berlin, the wrapping of the Reichstag by Christo and Jean-Claude. And here I have a very dark, I mean, all these pictures are dark and sinister, perhaps purposely so. Another image. It's a little better. This architecturally mediocre, massive building first housed the German parliament in the days of the Wilhelmian Empire and then played a crucial role both in the founding and toppling of the Weimar Republic, which was proclaimed from its balcony and gutted in the famous Reichstag fire after the Nazis' rise to power in 1933. After 1945, it stood as ruin and memorial to the failed republic, being turned into a museum of recent German history and used as ceremonial space, only to resume its symbolic political value during the National Unity celebration of October 1990. For 2 weeks this past summer, this building became temporarily invisible, its invisibility an international media event and popular love fest, that celebrated Germany and Berlin as only the falling of the wall had done 6 years before. For a brief moment, German history enjoyed the power of the Nibelung's helm that made him invisible. The proximity of monumental memory and monumental forgetting was there for those with eyes to see. Berlin's short-term redemption from history, it seemed, joined Bayreuth's redemption through love in feeding the underlying desire for forgetting. Some exuberant critics have predictably claimed that by transforming a monumental work of architecture into a gigantic sculpture, Christo and Jean-Claude turned a monument of German history into myth. With such a Wagnerian blending of history, myth, and the monumental, we are no longer surprised to find the project described in a prominent German art journal as a Gesamtkunstwerk, a total work of art, that made the German capital into the international capital of art. What I have argued so far amounts to a symptomatic, evil-eye view of those three cultural events in the summer of 1995. Redemption through love, redemption through memory, redemption through forgetting. But then some questions emerge. Isn't such a short-circuited argument structurally reminiscent of a simplistic anti-Wagnerianism and anti-monumentalism that collapses different historical, political, and aesthetic registers in a causal and teleological model that identifies Wagner's opus entirely with its consequences in the Third Reich? Furthermore, isn't it a kind of approach that creates its own good conscience by being properly anti-fascist 50 years after the end of the Third Reich, a kind of political correctness the German way? And thirdly, isn't it a kind of total criticism that reproduces what it attacks, namely the discursive totalitarianism that indeed underlies the utopia of the total work of art and that mars so much of Wagner's theoretical and critical writing? A different approach seems to be called for. After all, most agreed that the polypropylene-wrapped Reichstag, whose looks oscillated from shining silver in sunlight to muted gray on cloud-covered days to bluish-purple under the spotlights at night, was indeed serenely and at times uncannily beautiful, its spatial monumentality both dissolved and accentuated by a lightness of being that was in stark contrast with the visual memory of the heavy-set, now-veiled architecture. Can one really speak of redemption from history when the public discussions about the history and meaning of this building were never more intense than in the heated debates that raged in Parliament, in the media, and in the public at large about the merits of Christo's project? The paradox is that in years past, the real Reichstag may have been more invisible, visually and historically, than the veiled building was now. Christo's veiling, in a larger discursive and public context, did function as a strategy to make visible, to unveil, to reveal what was hidden when it was visible. Conceptually, the veiling of the Reichstag, I think, had another salutary effect. It muted the voice of politics as usual, the memory of speeches from its balcony, of the raising of flags on its roof, whether German or Soviet, of the official political rhetoric inside, and thus it opened up a space for reflection and contemplation as well as for memory. The transitoriness of the event itself, the artists refused to prolong the show upon popular demand, was such that it highlighted the temporality and historicity of built space, the tenuous relationship between remembering and forgetting. And the stunningly veiled building produced itself a memory quite different from that marked by the authoritarian inscription above its portal, Dem Deutschen Volke, i.e. given to the German people from up high. This new layer of public memory is now that of a genuinely popular event, of thousands of people milling around the building day after day, celebrating a symbol of German democracy in all its fragility and transitoriness. Now, thinking about this critical and anti-monumental dimension of Christo's project, which, by the way, I have no doubt Christo did not intend, I was reminded of Richard Wagner's own privileging of the transitory, the ephemeral, the provisional. Thus, when he first imagined a performance of Siegfried, he wrote to his friend Uhlig that the theater of planks and beams erected only for the occasion in a meadow near Zurich would be dismantled after 3 days and the score would be burnt. In a similar vein, when it came to build the theater in Bayreuth, Wagner always emphasized the provisional nature of the architecture, and Bayreuth as a building indeed turned out to be as anti-monumental as Garnier's Paris opera, completed in that same year of 1875, was indeed monumental. This is an image of the early Bayreuth. Wagner's brief collaboration with Gottfried Semper, major architect of the period, shipwrecked precisely because Wagner rejected Semper's monumental design for his festival house, which came to be known rather as the Bayreuth Barn. Here you see Semper's model. It is easy to imagine also how Wagner would have rejected Hitler's own proposal for a Festspielhaus designed by the architect Rudolf Emil Mewis, a project that was then aborted at the beginning of the war. I mean, you can see things become ever more monumental as they go along here. So if the design of the total work of art can be seen, and I would see it that way, as a monumentalism of the future, then it is to some extent counterbalanced by Wagner's very modern sensibility of the provisionality and ephemerality of institutionalized art in modernity. We could have the lights now again because the picture session is over. I'll just come back to one more picture at the very end of my talk. Monumental desire and the consciousness of the ephemeral, the transitory, are in uneasy tension in Wagner's mind, a fact which may explain Baudelaire's early interest in Wagner's art. The irony, of course, is that Bayreuth became monumental in its own ways and that Wagner's art has become enshrined, institutionalized, and packaged in precisely the ways he found most objectionable when he attacked the composer Meyerbeer, and yet desired ardently for himself the same kind of art. That, however, is no different than what happened to all of the subsequent modernisms and avant-gardes as well. But there's still a deeper linkage between Wagner and modernism. The growing recognition since Baudelaire of the provisional, the transitory, the ephemeral, and yes, the fashionable, as key parameters of modernity, generates at the opposing end of attention-filled axis the desire for lasting monumentality, what Paul Éluard called in an untranslatable phrase, le dur désir de durer. The anxiety produced by this tension then results in a paranoid aggressive streak in Wagner that couples the insight into the transitoriness of art with images of destruction, death, and catastrophe, not only by producing it, but by anticipating it in its vanishing. The only monument that counts is the one already imagined as a ruin. And I will come back a little later to this question of a monumentalism of destruction in Wagner, which I think does have a lot to do also with certain trends within modernism. My main point here, however, is a simple one. Against the gesture and the rhetoric of a total critique that simplistically identifies Wagner's music drama with a typical 19th century monumentalism, it is important to hold on to such ambiguities and contradictions. No doubt, Christo's project, too, had its own monumentality, an extremely seductive one at that, which, however, had nothing to do with death and destruction. It was exactly the monumentality of the rapt Reichstag that raised theoretical questions in my mind about the monumental as an aesthetic and a political category. At this point, a brief historical digression may be in order before I turn to the discourse of the monumental in Wagner's programmatic, theoretical, and critical writings. At stake in the cultural events and debates of this past German summer is an aesthetic consensus that reaches from the modernisms of the earlier 20th century all the way to the various postmodernisms of our own time. The name of this consensus is anti-monumentalism. The monumental, and here I'll just list some of the key characteristics of this discourse. The monumental is aesthetically suspect because it is tied to 19th century bad taste, to kitsch, and to mass culture. It is politically suspect because it is seen as representative of 19th century nationalisms and of 20th century totalitarianisms. It is socially suspect because it is the privileged mode of expression of mass movements and mass politics. It is ethically suspect because in its preference for bigness, it indulges in the larger than human, in the attempt to overwhelm the individual spectator. It is psychoanalytically suspect because it is tied to narcissistic delusions of grandeur and to imaginary wholeness. It is musically suspect because of Richard Wagner. In his essay, Suffering and Greatness of Richard Wagner, Thomas Mann was very much tuned to the ambiguities and ambivalences of Wagner's work, and he talked there about Wagner's monumentalizing claims as bad 19th century. And the monument mania of our own time brings to mind Walter Benjamin's entry in his Moscow Diaries, and I quote, "There's hardly a square in Europe whose secret structure was not profaned and impaired over the course of the 19th century by the introduction of a monument," end quote. Just as the temporal sensibility of the modernists directed their ire against tradition and the museal, leading them to disparage both the monumental and monumentality, the postmodernists, too, spoke in the name of a proper anti-monumentalism when they first attacked modernist architecture itself. The case illustrates how the passage of time itself often produces the perception of monumentality of that which has become congealed, ossified, canonized, even if in their original shape and form such works may have been thoroughly anti-monumental. Thus, as we heard in the last talk of the earlier session, the local and the regional were privileged by postmodern architects and critics like Ken Frampton over and against the universalizing claims of the Bauhaus and the descendants of the international style. The buildings of Gropius, Le Corbusier, Mies van der Rohe were attacked as monumentalizing emblems of the culture of industrial production, with concrete, glass, and steel as ossified signifiers of an increasingly one-dimensional and hegemonic architectural language. Indeed, architecture, for obvious reasons, serves as the primary medium when the reproach of monumentalism is at stake, the reproach that a cultural formation has become congealed, ossified, immobilized. Forgotten, it seems, is the classical trope according to which the geometrical harmonies of architecture echo those of music, a trope that was significantly refurbished in the Romantic period by writers such as Hoffmann, Schelling, and Goethe, among others, and was certainly well known to Wagner. The reductively pejorative equation of the monumental with the architectural in our own time results, of course, less from modernist skyscrapers than from the architectural phantasmagorias of Hitler and his master architect Albert Speer, who placed all the emphasis on the overwhelming and terrorizing effects of building as a tool of mass psychology and domination. Thus, for a post-1945 European sensibility, Michel Foucault could claim that what I am calling here the desire for the monumental represents, quote Foucault, the fascism in us all, in our heads and in our everyday behavior, the fascism that causes us to love power, to desire the very thing that dominates and exploits us, end quote. Against this anti-monumentalism as idée reçue of the 20th century, which has always played a central role in the discourse of the anti-Wagnerians above and beyond the uses and abuses of Wagner and the Third Reich, we should remind ourselves, I think, that monumentality as an aesthetic category is as historically contingent and unstable as any other aesthetic category. While the monumental may always be big and awesome, with claims to eternity and permanence, differing historical periods obviously have distinct experiences of what overwhelms, and their desire for the monumental will differ both in quality and in quantity. Thus, the seductive power of certain forms of 19th century monumentality, tied as they were to the political needs of nationalism and the cultural needs of the bourgeoisie, clearly do not match our aesthetic or political sensibilities. But that does not mean, I think, that we are free from monumental seductions per se. Once we focus on the historical specificity of monumentality, I could well imagine arriving at a conclusion that the identification of monumentalism with fascism and the collapsing of the desire for the monumental with masochism and self-annihilation becomes legible as itself a historical text rather than as a universal norm. What then of the discourse of the monumental in Richard Wagner? And here I will focus on the linkage between monumentalism and the very prominent discourse of architecture in Wagner's programmatic, critical, and theoretical writings, Wagner's overall aesthetic project. So I must disappoint those of you who had hoped I would speak about the operas. In his brilliant and imaginative study of Georges Bataille, entitled Against Architecture, Denis Ollier, a French literary and cultural critic working in the U.S., has pointed out how the search and desire for the monumental in modernity is always the search and desire for origins. Nowhere is this clearer than in the 19th century. The search for origins became inevitable once the political, economic, and industrial revolutions had begun to strip away the religious and metaphysical securities of earlier ages. The 19th century discourse of origins was produced by what Georg Lukács later termed transcendental homelessness as a modern condition, to which he opposed the utopia of an integrated civilization, his model, of course, in the German idealist tradition being Greece. We have come to read this 19th century obsession with origins and their mythic grounding as fulfilling the culturally legitimizing needs of the post-revolutionary bourgeois nation-state in the grip of accelerating modernization. At the same time, as the example of Lukács indicates, the search for origins and a new emergent culture could also take on an anti-Western, anti-capitalist, and anti-modern inflection. The obsession with origins and myth was not just reactionary state ideology or its cultural ideological reflection. Its truth, as Theodor Adorno has argued, was that it demonstrated how 19th century modernity itself, contrary to its liberal and progressive beliefs, remained bound up with the constitutive dialectic of Enlightenment and myth. And Wagner and his operas are a case in point. In order to better understand this link between myth, the monumental, and origins, it is also important to remember that for the 19th century, and contrary to our own time, the monumental was first and foremost embodied in the monuments of classical antiquity, monuments that more often than not were transmitted in the most fragmentary form. While classical monuments provided European nations an anchoring in their cultural roots, think of what some critics have called the tyranny of Greece over Germany, the search for national monuments first created the deep national past that differentiated a given culture both from its European and its non-European others. As ever more monuments were unearthed, Schliemann's excavations and the romance of archaeology attached to his name are paradigmatic here, the monument came to guarantee origin and stability, as well as depth of time and of space, in a rapidly changing world that was experienced as transitory, uprooting, and unstable. And the primary monument in the 19th century admiration for classical and so-called prehistoric antiquity was, of course, architecture. Thus, it was no coincidence that Hegel placed architecture at the very beginning of art. Monumental architecture especially, and think of the cult of obelisks, pyramids, temples, memorial, and burial towers in the 19th century, seemed to guarantee permanence and to provide the desired bulwark against the speed-up of time, the shifting grounds of urban space, the transitoriness of modern life. Richard Wagner was very much of this 19th century. He was not against architecture, as the modernist Bataille, but unhesitatingly for it. He was not against origins, but very much in search of them, not in favor of the pleasures of transitoriness and fashion, as Baudelaire was, but violently opposed to them, and in pursuit of a new permanent culture that would bring to fruition what he called the art world historical task of music. This concept of the art world historical task of art, hardly imaginable within French modernist discourse. And I would suggest that to see art as performing a world historical mission is indeed a peculiarly German phenomenon that resulted from the overprivileging of art and culture for the formation of national identity in a period preceding the formation of the German nation state in 1870-71, and that determined Wagner's self-image as the genius called upon by his necessity to give his German folk a new culture. Anyhow, Wagner's conception of art, drama, and music participates, this is my point here, in this widespread 19th century imaginary of triumphal architecture, stable origins, and mythic groundings of the nation. At the same time, the ostentatious monumentality of his artistic project, which he laid out most clearly in the essays of the late 1840s and early 1850s, takes shape against the backdrop of his vociferous opposition to a certain kind of 19th century monumentalism. His own monumental project of bringing to life the art of the future that would transcend the current stage of decadence and corruption and would be enshrined in the annual festivals in Bayreuth was clearly predicated on two assumptions: rejection of timeless classicist norms, which in his eyes failed to acknowledge the vital temporal and spatial boundedness of all art, and, secondly, the rejection of the historicizing architectural styles which he attributed to the corruptions of luxury and fashion. Thus we read in one of these essays, The Artwork of the Future, and I quote, "She, architecture that is, reproduces the buildings which earlier epochs had produced from their felt need of beauty. She pieces together the individual details of these works according to her wanton fancy. Out of a restless longing for alteration, she stitches every national style of building throughout the world into her motley disconnected botches. In short, she follows the caprice of fashion, whose frivolous laws she needs must make her own, because she nowhere hears the call of inner beautiful necessity," end quote. I don't think I need to comment on the incredible gendering of this whole discourse. It is easy to see how Wagner's critique of the monumental, of this kind of 19th century historicizing monumental, already anticipates Nietzsche's reflections on monumental history. But it was then the same Nietzsche who, in one of his posthumously published fragments from 1878, first pointed to the underlying contradiction in Wagner's fight against monumentality. I quote, "Wagner fights the monumental, but believes in the universally human," end quote. In a similarly contradictory way, Wagner uses a universalizing and mythic image of architecture to ground his own claims of an aesthetic monumentality adequate to an emerging new culture, that of the music drama as the new total work of art. The very notion of the total work of art, this is my claim here, is fundamentally architectural. Indeed, the metaphor of architecture functions like a leitmotif in all of Wagner's reflections on art and revolution, the artwork of the future, opera and drama, and A Communication to My Friends, to mention only the key programmatic texts, all written at the time when he was conceptualizing the Ring tetralogy. Despite his trenchant critique of the monumental and of classicist norms, the primary model for the artwork of the future is indeed given by Greek tragedy, and the myth of Antigone becomes the founding stone for Wagner's ideology of an absolute and redeeming love as the precondition for the collapse of the existing state, where he particularly talks about the Antigone story. But in a move typical of 19th century cultural history, the normative character of Greek tragedy is framed by a historical narrative of decay and rebirth, which receives its mid-19th century spin from a theory of capitalism as decadence, corruption, and pollution of the German folk. This notion of decay and rebirth is articulated in the first pages of Art and Revolution, and I quote, Hand in hand with the dissolution of the Athenian state marched the downfall of tragedy. As the spirit of community split itself along 1,000 lines of egoistic cleavage, so was the total work of art of tragedy disintegrated into its individual factors. Above the ruins of tragic art was heard the cry of the mad laughter of Aristophanes, the maker of comedies. And at the bitter end, every impulse of art stood still before philosophy, who read with gloomy mien her homilies upon the fleeting stay of human strength and beauty. End quote. Wagner's own monumental claim to rebuild from the ruins of Greek tragedy and to recreate the total work of art against 2,000 years of world history is thus predicated on a world in ruins, not in the future, but in the deep past. If, however, the origin itself is already conceptualized as ruin, it is hard to imagine how the projected future of the total work of art will avoid a similar fate. And then Wagner takes a second step, which translates the historical topos of the rise and fall of cultures, Greek culture in that case, into a plainly mythic dimension, which posits some disastrous ending already in the very act of foundation. In a key passage from this same essay, The Artwork of the Future, he compares the ruins of tragedy to the ruins of the Tower of Babel. And I quote, "Just as in the building of the Tower of Babel, when their speech was confounded and mutual understanding made impossible, the nations severed from each other, each one to go its own separate way. So when all national solidarity had split into 1,000 egoistic particularities, did the separate branches cut off themselves from the proud and heaven-soaring building of drama, which had lost the inspiring soul of mutual understanding." End quote. The theme of building a new culture and creating the art adequate to the coming age is always predicated in Wagner on destruction and ruins. This is my main point here. Wagnerian music drama thus rises programmatically from the ruins of earlier opera, just as, in his words, the fullest flower of pure human love sprang amid the ruins of love of sex, of parents, and of siblings. In a letter to his friend Ulich of 1851, which describes the projected tetralogy in some detail, Wagner had this to say about a performance of The Ring. Quote, "I can only conceive of performing it after the revolution. Only the revolution can provide me with the artists and the audience. Inevitably, the next revolution must bring an end to our whole theater business. The theaters must and will all collapse. This is unavoidable. From their ruins, I will then call up what I need. Only then will I find what I need. I shall erect a theater on the banks of the Rhine and issue invitations to a great dramatic festival. After a year's preparation, I shall produce my complete work in the course of 4 days. With this production, I will then convey the meaning of this revolution in its noblest sense to the people of the revolution. This audience will understand me. The current audience is unable to." End quote. Here, in late 1851, less than a month before Louis Napoleon's 18th premiere, Wagner imagines the future as Bonapartist aesthetic putsch, laced with a Bakuninian anarchist desire and a reactionary German populism. And just as Louis Napoleon claimed the mantle of his great uncle, Wagner's ambition was to be perceived as a successor to the two towering artists of the preceding period, Goethe and Beethoven. But what this reveals is precisely the desire for monumentality, a monumentality that is characterized by an intense inferiority complex toward these predecessors, whose achievements Wagner often despaired of matching. But contrary to either Goethe or Beethoven, Wagner's fantasies of the future are always predicated on death, destruction, disaster, both in his theoretical writings and in his music dramas. Thus the new world promised by Siegfried in The Ring would rise from the ruins of Valhalla, the ruins of a castle, in other words, a castle of the dead to begin with. Architecture as burial site and memorial of heroic death or failure, thus standing both at the beginning and ending of time. The key function of this vision of monumentality emerges here. It guarantees the presence of the dead, without whose sacrifice there can be no new culture. The leitmotif of architecture in ruins provides mythic closure to Wagner's romantic quest. What is being built is always already a cemetery, a memorial to failure and disaster. Wagner's antipathy toward the monumental as classicist norm is grounded in his imaging the monumental as ruin only, for only ruins have permanence. And this is where 19th century discourse of the monument as ruin meets with Albert Speer's ruin theory of architecture, which had the express intent to build in such a way that the greatness of the Third Reich would still be visible in its ruins 1,000 years hence. It was the last stage of a romanticism of ruins in which an originally, in the 18th century, melancholy and contemplative impulse had been transformed into an imperialist project of conquering both time and space. Here, too, Wagner appears Janus-faced, looking both backwards to romanticism and forwards to a violent, engulfing future. The simultaneity of the desire for permanence and the anticipation of destruction reminds me of Elias Canetti's reflection on Hitler's hesitation over whether or not to destroy Paris. Canetti read Hitler's dilemma as the twofold delight in permanence and in destruction, characteristic of the paranoiac. And of course, Wagner saw himself, and these are his own words, as the plenipotentiary of catastrophe. And in another letter to his friend Ulich of 1850, shortly after publishing his anti-Semitic tract, Judaism in Music, he wrote, and I quote, "In total calm, and without any hoax, I assure you that the only revolution I believe in is the one that begins with the burning down of Paris." In the end, of course, Paris was not burned, not even by the Nazis. But the German state had collapsed 4 times in 1 century. And yet, fortunately, the new monumental culture Wagner intended to found with his music drama on the ruins of the state never arrived, nor did the new Aristophanes, who would sit crying and laughing, hysterically, I presume, on top of the ruins of Wagner's total work of art. None of that happened. Instead, Bayreuth, as a theatrical operatic institution, is well and alive, and we have The Ring of the Nibelung now as comic book, and the program note description of a recent Met production in New York as Dallas on the Rhine, after this famous American soap opera. It's actually a very accurate description of The Ring. So we may not need another Aristophanes sitting and crying on the ruins, and that may be just as well. But what then of the monumental today? Just a few final comments. Our own way of possibly enjoying an aesthetics of monumentality, if we can bring ourselves to admit that the monumental can be enjoyed, it must not be rejected at all cost, seems to me embodied rather in Christo's wrapping of the Reichstag, just as an example. I don't want to extrapolate too much from there. But it seems to be a monumentality that can do without permanence and without destruction, a monumentality that is fundamentally informed by the modernist spirit of a fleeting and transitory epiphany, but which is no less memorable or monumental for that. Its monumentality was that of the great cultural event disseminated and immemorialized by the media, an event that was monumental and anti-monumental at the same time. But then the Christo project was an art event, an installation. It was not designed as permanent built space, and thus its celebration begs the question of whether a monumental architecture is possible today or even desirable. And this brings me to my final reflection, not an answer to this question, but rather a reflection that opens up, I think, another set of questions inherent in Christo's project. In 1943, in New York, the painter Fernand Léger, the architect and town planner José Luis Sert, and the historian Siegfried Gideon argued for the need of a new monumentality in architecture. They wrote a programmatic statement entitled 9 Points on Monumentality. In it, they argued against the pseudo-monumentality of the 19th century, as much as against the pure functionalism of the Bauhaus and the international style. Their theses were informed by the democratic conviction that there is a need for public space, for monumental space in a democratic culture. Now, it is easy to see that the fate of public space in Western culture in the past decades has been tied to the further decline of monumentality rather than to its resurrection in any form. Perhaps the wrapping of the Reichstag in Berlin, which can now only be had in reproducible media images, from postcards to t-shirts to coffee cups, is indeed symptomatic of the fate of the monumental in our postmodern times. What I'm suggesting is that maybe the monumental has migrated from built space into the image, from the material into the immaterial, and ultimately into the digitized computer bank. As so often in media politics, the Nazis may have had the right instinct when they mass-distributed images of Speer's models in the form of postcards. And in Germany, there are still many people today who believe that these things were actually built at the time, which they never were. The monumental effect of architecture then could as easily, through the postcards, and perhaps even better be achieved, say, by a high-angle totalizing image. No need even to build the real thing. 50 and some years later, our own monumental seduction may indeed be no longer tied up with real built space at all. It may all be in cyberspace and the information highway. And if we could dim the lights, I have a last image now, somewhat anecdotal rather than perhaps totally persuasive, but nevertheless. This is an ad that appeared recently in the New York Times. And here I would say that it's basically an image of the Brandenburg Gate. The Germans here, in seamless and oblivious continuity with another monumental Nazi project, the building of the Autobahns, the national freeways, call it Infobahn, and the Deutsche Telekom, the national telecommunications conglomerate, describes it without hesitation as the fast lane to the future. This indicates, it seems to me, that monumentality is well and alive. Thank you.
Talk is open to the audience. I must confess that I slightly wrongly cued the audience to what Andreas was speaking today. As a matter of fact, possibly some of the questions about the postmodern and the avant-garde he'll raise on Sunday in his seminar presentation. This talk, to my mind, led in several directions for us, but needs to be translated into terms that would be possibly historically relevant to us today. But I think that mediation, I don't feel competent in doing, and I would suggest that, in fact, instead of just questions, perhaps somebody in the audience would feel competent to actually formulate this for the purpose of our discussion, if that is possible. So several cues come to mind.
I just wanted to say two things. The first was the inclusiveness of Wagner's aesthetic allows for contradictory accommodation of contradictory positions. Baudelaire heard in Wagner's music the last scream of someone driven mad, whereas Nietzsche, given up on Wagner, praised him as one of the greatest intimists in music. And I think the same sort of accommodation of contraries is very aesthetic, in the sense that the inclusiveness coexists with what Adorno criticizes Wagner when he talks about the leitmotifs, which become detachable and therefore sort of fetched objects. So that's one thing. But the other thing about the monument, I thought Benjamin's idea about the arcades as a kind of anti-monument, and perhaps Claes Oldenburg in the 60s proposing a kind of deflationary monument as well. And two different.
Okay. I have to the first question, to the first part of the question. It seems that it sort of you talk about the way in which Wagner, the Wagner reception has indeed been extraordinarily broad, and you know, quoting Adorno is important, I think, in the sense that, or citing Adorno in this context is important in that he was one who went against a kind of simplistic anti-Wagnerianism that condemned Wagner as a result of the implications of, you know, the Wagner cult during the Third Reich. This debate, however, has, I think, and so Adorno was, I think, successful in some ways of mediating between Wagnerians and anti-Wagnerians without, however, abandoning entirely the, you know, the political critique of the notion of the Gesamtkunstwerk, of the total work of art, which he does very, you know, beautifully in the book by focusing just on microstructures in Wagner's work rather than on the macro aspect. I mean, which is an idea that he actually did take from Nietzsche. In the meantime, however, there is new research, and I mean, this is more now still, you know, within the context of this paper, that has, I think, quite persuasively shown that Wagner's racism is not limited to his political tracts, to an essay like Judaism in Music, but that it is inherent, actually, to the dramaturgy, to the librettos, and even to the music itself. And I'm referring here to a book by that was published last year by Mark Weiner called Richard Wagner and the Anti-Semitic Imagination. So this kind of split that is, of course, fairly frequently made by critics, art critics, literary critics, between the political side of an artist that one doesn't like and the artwork cannot really be maintained in that way. And I think that, you know, this, which is not to say that one shouldn't listen to Wagner or that he should be banned, which I think he still is in Israel.
No, I think he's sublime.
Pardon?
I think Parsifal is sublime. But
yeah. Well, there are other readings of that sublimity. I mean, Slavoj Žižek reads it as a...
I use sublime in what's called.
Oh, okay, yeah. You know, I think the battle lines about Wagner are still very much there. And one purpose of my paper here was really to work out, to work on this imagination of the future as based on ruin, as on destruction. One point. The second point linked to that, a point which I take from Adorno, is Wagner is not just a 19th century figure, but he already embodies a key moment of what came to be known as modernism and possibly avant-gardism of a later point. And this, it seemed, I mean, this problematic might sort of provide a way into the discussion. The second point, I agree with you, the anti-monumental in someone like Oldenburg and in other artists is definitely there, but anti-monumentalism we have, you know, we do have, of course, a lot. I'm just not sure how much that was actually seen as a as even tied to the discourse of the monumental, how much the Oldenburg was seen at that time as tied to the discourse of the monumental.
But I thought Benjamin proposing the arcade as a kind of profane anti-monument.
And as a, also of course as a, you know, as a kind of public space, which however does then have its own problems, right? Because it turns, if you look at the arcade historically, I mean, how can you help in the end talking about 20th century malls? And the mall as public space is something, you know, fundamentally, I think, insidious and quite contrary to Benjamin's understanding of the arcades.
There's a point between the 19th century looking back, monumentality which looks back, and Christos meeting monumentality, which might be represented by the Eiffel Tower, I think, which is central to early modernism. And may have been perhaps an absence in your talk. That there are not just these two kinds of modernism. Modernism of monumentality, which neither looks back to a past or to origins, nor is fleeting.
Nor as what?
Fleeting, as Christo's monument.
Yeah, and what would that be? The monumentality that neither looks back to the past nor is fleeting.
I'm talking of the Eiffel Tower in particular as an emblem of that sort of monumentality.
Could you cite other examples?
Well, Manhattan, I think, in modernist text,
yeah.
becomes that kind of emblem also. For people like Picabia and Duchamp who moved there.
Yeah, but if I take that as, if I were to think it, it's true. I mean, I did not talk about those kinds of aspects, but there is a kind of, also a kind of hope, a kind of monumentality of the future in that, right? In those, I mean, the Brooklyn Bridge or the, you know, Eiffel Tower. And it represents a monumentality that indeed is not predicated in its constitutive moment on, you know, on the ruin necessarily. But it's also very, well, I guess you're suggesting that it's very different from this fleeting moment. The question that I would have is whether for us today it isn't a kind of monumentality of the past of the modern, and whether it doesn't get nostalgically coded in that way. And one could ask how one deals with that aspect.
Could I just say, however, that one could bring into this discourse also Dublin Tower, which
if it remains at the level of a project, could have a different series of allegorical readings for us today.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, Catlin's Tower would be one of the few modernist monuments, but it wasn't built. Another one that
precisely because it wasn't built, it could be of use. There are two questions, Laleen and Timothy.
It's too hard to my question. One to do with, say, the Wagnerian notion of destruction and ruin. How is that notion different from Benjamin's Baroque aesthetic, his modernist reading of the Baroque, German Baroque, where the figure of the ruin becomes a key emblem of something? Yes, the idea of the fragment, which is precisely not monumental. But I'd like to speak to that. And the other thing is, when the fascinating issue is the Lehman boom, the modification of memory, and how through the very act of memorializing, you impact, destroy memory or the capacity to remember. So, could you speak some more about something about, how memory is about temporality, but how memory itself is dismembered and forgotten, as it were, of the capacity.
In the memory boom.
The phrase memory boom suggests the commodification of memory itself, of the capacity to remember. So memory is dismembered, as it were, and destroyed. And this has something to do with the temporality of fashion as well.
Yeah, I think these are two very good questions. I'm not sure whether I can address the second one as fully as it should be, as it deserves to be addressed. And the first one, the difference between Wagner and Benjamin, I would simply say that Wagner wants destruction, and Benjamin sees the world as catastrophe, as destruction, wants redemption. Okay, and does not, with that redemption, wants to go beyond the level of destruction, while Wagner, I think, never, if one takes the endings of his operas, never gets beyond that stage of destruction. And then, of course, the other, you know, you gave yourself the part of the answer when you pointed to very different aesthetic notions in both of them. Where in Wagner, you do have this kind of totalizing need to bring together all the different media in the, in his music drama, while Benjamin works with it through the fragment. Benjamin works through this time level before, you know, redemption, with fragment, with montage, and so forth and so on. The second question about the memory boom, I must say I'm very ambivalent about it. But I don't think I would necessarily agree with you, and this may just be a sort of heuristic moment in my thinking, in saying that commodification destroys the capacity to remember. I know what you would be referring to with that. There is indeed a kind of production of historical memory through spectacle, through mise-en-scene, with museum shows, with television programs, and so forth, and so on, which has many of us extremely suspicious about what is going on there. I would, however, you know, want to resist an argument that would say because memory is here being commodified through images, through production, through museum shows, and so forth, that this necessarily disables the possibility of memory. Because if it does that, since, and I'm speaking now from my position within, you know, within the Western world, if it does that, then there is no chance at all to have memory, because there's no escape to commodification. So then the question is, how can one get, I mean, it's a theoretical, methodological question, how can one get out of this sort of dead-end commodification argument? And I try to do that a little bit in my book, in my work on the museum, where I'm trying to ask the question, what is it that actually brought about this memory boom, where you had, and I had some figures in my head 10 years ago, in Germany, for instance, more people went to museums than to soccer games. Now, that is astounding. That is astounding. And there are, of course, there are class issues, there are issues of tourism, there are issues of increased mobility, and so forth and so on, involved in that. In the United States, in 1982, there was total visitors statistics for museums showed 32 million. By 10 years later, by 1992, it had gone up to 50 million. So there is a phenomenon there which one could describe, you know, just very briefly, as a need for memory, as a need for history. The question that you're raising, of course, is that need for memory, is that need for history? Well, first of all, where does it come from? Because the normal argument was always in the West, I mean, Jameson's argument about postmodernism, it's all amnesia. I mean, there is no memory, there is no temporality. History has been destroyed. So where does this need come from, and how does it get satisfied? And my position, if I have to take a position, I'm always reluctant to take positions on things rather than trying to think them through, but my position would be to grant this kind of spectacular memorial culture some kind of, you know, kernel of reality, that there's something aesthetic and social and political going on that is quite important for these, you know, for Western societies. It is not just nostalgia. It is not just pastiche and, you know, and spectacle and commodification. But what that is, you know, of course, the, you know, question that is hard to, you know, hard to get at.
In fact, the first part of your answer to Nalin about Benjamin would in fact throw a different light on the second question that you started asking on commodification in memory. Surely Benjamin was the first one, in fact probably the only Marxist who seriously confronted the question of memory and commodification in his incomplete Archive project. I mean, wasn't that in Archive project was really an attempt to think about memory. Rather than positing a kind of a memoriality and regret its absence, think through the historicity of commodification. When he talked about the real world of commodity, the importance of, you know, different kind of documentation of those. Because this the other kind of position, a crude Adornian or a sort of, you know, position which sort of simply thinks of commodification as negation of memory, it seems to negate only one kind of a memoriality. Whereas Benjamin was perhaps the only one who tried to hold on to something else, something far more interesting and complex.
I would say Adorno also tied on to a notion of memory, except it could not be fulfilled, it could not be articulated within, you know, within the mode of the culture industry. I mean, that's where I see them sort of, you know, relatively similar rather than totally opposed. But the problem is, I mean, the problem for me with Benjamin's work on memory is this theological dimension that he has in it. And I'm just, you know, myself far too secular in my thinking that I can easily translate that into, you know, into a contemporary discourse. I mean, I can understand it, where it came from, Benjamin, I mean, the young generation of German Jews being critical of the liberalism of their, you know, of their bourgeois parents, trying to reclaim a tradition, a Judaic tradition, and sort of blending that in some ways with, you know, with Marxism, with psychoanalysis, and so forth. But I'm not sure whether theoretically that is a model that would be very useful in the, you know, in the current conjuncture. That's why I would move against Adorno and argue that we have to live with commodification and find, you know, try to open up the commodity fetish to what is socially and politically possible within it, rather than outside of it. Because Benjamin, it seems to me, does ultimately go outside it. I mean, I'm not sure whether I'm clear, but...
Can I just take two questions that have already been posed? Timothy and Kumar Chandra.
When you said that the social work of art, the Gesinnte Konferenz, was fundamentally architectural, I find myself thinking, you know, what were the monuments that meant so much to me after, well, in my youth, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and I think of cinema. I think of the monumental films of his Johnson, the Tarkovsky. And I wonder how you feel about that. I mean, to me, those views on Wagnerian dimension in a way that I certainly didn't feel about the fantasy that we had. And I think a lot of people felt that, that there was something exemplary about the cinema for those years, which had something among it, which affirmed the kind of thing it had. I wonder what you feel about
that. I tell you the truth, I haven't thought about it. So I now have to think about it and say something fast. But I did not have, I don't think I would say that I had that experience. I mean, I saw that kind of filmmaking, that kind of auteurist filmmaking of the 50s and 60s, also then up to, you know, including someone like Godard Godard's different, yeah. But I saw all of that. I mean, at the time, I think rather in the mode, at a time when I had not really developed a, you know, critique, any kind of critique of auteurism as a, you know, as a proper modernist kind of mode of articulation of expression. I don't think I would have seen it as monumental.
Argument, because it is also the deconstruction of that monumentality in late Fellini.
Yeah.
Kumar?
Could you permit something that could be a part observation? Lalin's intervention through the whole session and now has been wonderful in pinpointing what the actual situation surrounding postmodern thought is. And it seems to revolve very often around the question of temporality and memory. And I'm not at all surprised. So it makes me shudder as well. There is a possibility that through this very process of theorization about postmodernism and its differences, that we may be very close to the endorsing of a loss of memory, in fact, you know, loss of tradition. And I want to connect that up with the fear of monumentality, you know. This is being induced in any case, as perhaps your latest book shows, you know, on Amnesia. It's being induced by several social circumstances. And it seems to me that the methodology of approaching amnesia in our time might also endorse that very amnesia. It's an observation. I just want to put it to you and to Lalin, especially because he has often referred to the temporal question. You know, for instance, it came up when I was subtitling a film of mine, which was based on the past. It was going to an audience somewhere else, and I had attempted to translate it in archaic mode.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the person who
that the re-subtitling story, although so spent, almost had a disastrous end of friendship, because she said that the tenses don't work any longer, you know. So there's a breakdown of tenses, you know, this is what I want to get to, which seems to be appearing. And as we deal with with that breakdown of tenses, we naturally need to invent a new language to be able to deal with that new language. And as a result, we completely abandon notions of temporality with which we have been equipped through the centuries in different cultures and in different modes. You know, like Wagner's temporality is extremely is different from, let us say, not only the temporality of Beethoven, but the temporality of Chinese music of that time, or Indian music of this time, and so on. So I just wanted to put this sort of question to you and to Lali especially.
Well, I think you articulated it, the dilemma and the problem here, very cogently, in that the, you know, the production of memory can indeed also lead, be precisely part of the production of amnesia, precisely by virtue of overload. I mean, overload through the new media, particularly in, I mean, information highway, cyberspace, and so forth. I mean, that's what I would be first thinking of in the, you know, in the Western context. You also mentioned that the memory boom is, of course, is induced by significant social and political phenomena, and that gets me back to, you know, the earlier question. It may, in Western societies, it has very much to do with the waning of the generation of Auschwitz survivors. I mean, I think that is a key moment at this point. People who, for the first time in their lives, have begun to speak and to testify about that period. And the question may be that indeed commodification will continue its drive toward amnesia by just moving to some kind of other topic in another 5 years. And that the whole memory boom that we're witnessing now, we have witnessed in the past 10 years, will be something of the past and will be forgotten as any other earlier, you know, culturally produced boom. That is indeed the, I think that is the, you know, that is the danger. But I would not, I would still want to maintain a kind of open space for discussions of temporality within the postmodern, given that it seems to me that postmodernism discussions have very often actually blocked out the questions of temporality. I mean, certainly in the codifications of the postmodern by somebody like Jameson, who was enormously influential for the whole discourse in the early to mid-1980s, the whole problematic of temporality was sort of relegated to the period of high modernism. Postmodernism was supposed to be about space. Now, Jameson, of course, if one were to talk to him, he would probably modify it. He always makes these outrageous kind of statements in some of his essays. But, I mean, this is just, you know, one reason why I, you know, where I have to agree and disagree. I mean, I think that I think there is no way around. I mean, if I take the Holocaust memory as an example, there is no way of getting around secondary and tertiary images of the Holocaust in order to construct that memory. There is no way to have authentic memory once this generation passes. Now, memory is a very broad term, and I think one has to talk about it in terms of generational memory, in terms of social memory, which becomes quite vague because then, you know, you have different social classes, different memory, different trends of memory become important, and you have to talk about official memory, state memory, national memory. I still do think that, you know, you probably wouldn't disagree with me if I say that if one immediately argues that all memory gets commodified in this current memory boom, in this commodifying discourse, then, you know, we block any entrance into the question of memory itself unless we have somehow magically, mystically, some other solution from somewhere else, which I at this point can't see. I mean, that's why I'm using the strategy of trying to, you know, open up questions of memory from within the culture industry, from within commemoration.
I want to go with that and just add to the typology of memory the notion of artificial. I'd like to add to the typology of memory that you just mentioned the notion of artificial memory, which would work with computer memory as well, and then talk about two kinds of amnesia and memory. One is the kind of amnesia that we all deplore, you know, the capacity to kind of erase the past because of the surfeit of information. Then there's another kind of forgetting that's essential to remembering, according to Raoul Ruiz. The condition of remembering is that you forget, because if you're in a saturated space, there's voluntary memory and involuntary memory, Benjamin's categories, through Proust. Voluntary memory is cliche, you have to kind of, if you're Proust, you cork up your room and try to get rid of that. Otherwise, you have to cultivate techniques of forgetting in order to remember.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me film has a really important function now in distinguishing different temporalities between the cinematic temporality and the computer kind of temporality. Yeah, because computer temporality does it connects immediately. It destroys space, yeah? Well, I don't know enough.
End time.
End time
in some sense. Yeah.
Okay. So I think it's really interesting to think about someone like Chaplin, who faced this question at the beginning of the history of cinema, and someone like Robert Altman in his latest film, Pret-a-Porter, where have people seen that film here?
No.
The last nude fashion show, the shock of that is that when those models come out, I thought they were images from Auschwitz of emaciated bodies coming out. And then I read the scriptwriter who said she had that image in mind, which means that the Adorno Auschwitz is like ground zero for thinking of art. For Altman, it's a recyclable image, so that he can give us like half a second in which to think about the distinction between cinema, what can cinema do now at the end of this century of cinema, as distinct from all the other media in the film, you know, the television, the other stuff that's like instantaneous replay. That's why that film was hated by everyone, because people wanted it to give a definitive statement on fashion. And Altman is asking the question, what can cinema do today in the heart of the most spectacular commodity, fashion? Yeah. So, I think cinema is, Kumar. Cinema is there.
I come back to you. And to Laline, of course. The thing is that it seems to me that also we need to re-question the notion of how the commodity operates now, you know, in this situation of temporality, where the tenses have been broken down, and where the computers or artificial intelligence and intelligence amplification, which is virtual, you know, virtual reality, is going to take over a different kind of and produce a different kind of temporality, where both the condensations and the elaborations are quite amazing, you know, and quite different, even further than going into areas which film had not touched upon, and where a sort of virtual commodification is taking place, you know, where because in commodity exchange, you have memory as the labor that went into commodity, to the creation of a commodity. And then you had an exchangeable thing, an exchangeable object, or an exchangeable word, or an exchangeable work of art, something or the other, you know. Now, you are not able to exchange anything, and along with it, you're not able to actually remember, you know, the process of creating language itself. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a kind of amnesia that we have to face up to. I don't think that we are living in the classical commodity age any longer after the late 1980s, and especially after the fall of the Soviet Union. But there doesn't seem to be even a possibility of a return to the classical theory of commodification itself. There seems to be something terribly dangerous round the corner, which we are not quite aware of.
Well, that's why I try to end with this notion that our fascination with the monumental, our seduction of the monumental, who is our, but those who celebrate cyberspace, of which there are many in the United States, and not only in Germany, the telecom, that is exactly, that is the monumentalism of the present, because it has some of the key features of traditional monumentality. It overwhelms, the desire for political domination is inscribed into it, control of information is inscribed into it, and so forth and so on. And it also eliminates, because of its structure of synchronicity, it eliminates lived temporality. But then if one doesn't want to be as pessimistic as you seem to be about it, I would say I would still want to make a distinction in saying that, and this is a not very sophisticated kind of statement, but people don't live their lives as simulation. And probably they won't in 20 years either. I mean, I think one can take the Baudrillardian kind of theorizing too far, which is always a danger when among people who have already begun by denying a level of referentiality, a level of reality to which signifying systems still prefer. I think that, there is one element of... there are people, of course, who are working with computers. I mean, those are the people who do worry me more than others. And actually, including some of the architects who work in the sort of deconstructionist mode in Columbia's architecture school. Somebody there told me recently, and I'm not passing this on for fact, but more as anecdote and by hearsay, a colleague there described to me how they're working with these incredibly fanciful new computers, which otherwise are only available in big business and in Hollywood, making all kinds of models and animations and so forth and so on. And I asked, what will they build? And I think when you talked about, you said you couldn't give us a building, a Deleuzian kind of building, and they all read Deleuze. They do nothing. They read Deleuze and do computers. And then I was told, well, they don't build. They go to Hollywood, start computer business, and do animation. I mean, that's the future of public space.
I'm just going to ask you, there are three questions and four questions. How much stamina do you have? Shall we continue, or...?
That's fine. I begin to ramble, I'm afraid, so... But you, I don't know how the audience wants.
Would the audience like to continue?
Yeah.
Okay, Ashish, Kumar, Virginia, I don't know your name. Okay.
One thing that does occur to me, and it's something that I was sort of battling with right through your paper, given the kind of thing that Geeta talked about earlier about us translating what you were saying to some extent in our terms, I think that there might be one slight difference, which is that...
Difference between what now?
Difference between how we would look at monumentality from how you said translated it, which is that, yes, of course the problem of referentiality is important, but... To some extent, within your paper, there has been this question in from Wagner himself as to how you actually, in a sense, realize that monumentality in actual public terms.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, I suspect that the problem of realizing that monumentality in public terms was less the issue than the one of, A, how that monumentality is actually constructed as part of a kind of social imaginary, and the right to deploy that monumentality as something that would construct that imaginary and different sort of contestatory notions of that imaginary. in that situation, it's not been such a problem actually of trying to realize the damn thing as much as trying to in some way kind of inject it into certain kinds of discourses, for which we now have a 104-year sort of history, which goes back to social reformers in the late 19th century supporting, say, Sati. And I mean, in fact, there'd be elements of, say, Anand Kumaraswamy, you know, that could do this. The problem that then emerges actually for us in the context of temporality is I think quite interesting, which is that we then start deploying, and cinema is a good example of this, we then start deploying these technologies of the monumental as certain kinds of shortcuts for what would otherwise be more difficult problems for us to overcome. You know, we tend to sort of then present this as something that would kind of get us around problems that would otherwise not be so easily sort of negotiable, except in a
Can you give an example of that?
The one example I can give concerns television, and we know what's happened to television today. Dr. Vikram Sarabhai, the father of the Indian Space Research Program and an aeroite, said in the late 60s that the two major problems facing modern India today were geographical distance and linguistic diversity. And he thought television could solve those problems overnight. Hence television. That's a crude sort of example, I guess, but there are others. I mean, basically, where, say, cinema, for example, has been very good at this, at providing a certain kind of interface where the process of a certain kind of narrative enactment of us as if we were historical, you know, agents, allows us to sort of get around certain kinds of other problems, which may probably sort of, you know, provide you with evidence other than cyberspace, for what actually happens when monumentality disappears in certain kinds of discourses, you know, outside the rest of the
world. Yeah, can I take that as a comment?
Yeah, I might just say a sentence. I thought that what we could do, and it needn't be done today, it's a long session already, is that one cue that seemed to me would allow us to extend our discourse on this question would be through Andreas' speaking of the monumental as a search for origin, the grounding of the monumental in myth, and its relationship to the making of a nation state and to nationalism. And I think that here we have actually, in the destruction of the Babri Masjid, many of these issues inscribed, as well as critiqued, both first invested into that monument and then critiqued via our critiquing of our political processes through it. I thought that might come up somewhere, but if it hasn't, there are other questions. There's Vivan, there's Colin, and there is Virginia. Gosh, four. I think we'll have to somewhere wind up, but let's see. Okay.
I wonder whether you saw the exhibition in Berlin called Moscow Berlin.
I did.
Well, an observation, I saw it very fleetingly, but there seemed at one level to be, it's Moscow Berlin 1900 to 1950, where there was a continuity between modernism and then, as you moved up onto the second floor, how both totalitarian and fascist architecture, which occupied more and more space and presented in this spectacular fashion, sort of dominated the exhibition, and that by design or by default, Tatlin's star was just alone by itself in a space, but that this huge space was joined together by the museum design by what could only be called a kind of 50s or 60s minimalist massive piece of black and red, and one could think of Who's Afraid of Black and Red, kind of 50s minimalist art, so that actually there was a strange kind of continuity, and that monumentality absolutely dominated the show. And then if you open the magazine, the popular magazine, Spiegel, you found this architecture as well as Soviet socialist realism and that kind of classical art that Hitler supported also being given the dominant space. So there seemed to be a continuity of modernism and
and socialist, realist, and fascist art.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and well, I don't know what the brief was, but
I didn't quite read this show as even having such a thesis. This thesis, however, that the avant-garde is just an early stage of socialist realism, is a thesis that has been advanced by a number of people in recent years, that the avant-garde, in other words, was already always totalitarian. I mean, the key text for that is a text by a Russian exile who works in Germany, Boris Groys, whose book is called Stalin, Total Work of Art. The problem with that book is that it takes just certain kind of concepts of avant-gardism, namely the knowledge about the future being at the cutting edge, everybody has to follow. The avant-garde is the, you know, the front troops of a mass movement and so forth and so on, but it never really reads works. It never really engages, you know, painting or concrete artworks on the, you know, on the detailed level. However, it seems to me that there is a, I mean, there's some truth in this proposition, and, you know, I mean, I don't want to immediately reject it, because there is also, there has been in fascism research, increasingly people have argued that fascism cannot just be seen, and I think that is correct, as a, you know, a counterposition to modernity, to, you know, the Enlightenment, which would be the old Marxist view of somebody like Lukács, for instance, who makes a clear kind of distinction, Marxism, rationalism, fascism, irrationalism, and sort of traces it back in European intellectual history. But that there are indeed elements of, you know, modernism and modernization that actually also work into you know, artistic practices in the Third Reich, which is not Hitler's architecture, you know, the kind of megalomaniac classicism of Hitler's architecture, but is visible in other areas. And I think those kinds of, there are certain kinds of continuities, I think, that this view has forced upon us, which I would accept against the comfortable old notion that modernism is the good thing and totalitarian art is the bad thing. You can show certain kinds of avant-garde continuities, for instance, in early propaganda posters of, you know, the first five-year plan in the Soviet Union. But that doesn't mean to me, that does of course not mean that the avant-garde, that the secret telos, the hidden telos of the Soviet avant-garde of the 20s would have been Stalin, or that the telos of Georges Grosz and Bert Brecht was Adolf Hitler. I mean, this is just nonsense.
But there would have to be some limits to this kind of subsumption of movements historically grounded at certain junctures,
yeah,
which one can read historically, which don't only have to be read in retrospection. There would have to be some distinction made. They can't all be collapsed into a retrospective model of the telos that should...
Precisely, but there are. What is interesting, of course, that it is exactly in the discourse of a kind of anti-European, anti-modern attitude in intellectual life in the U.S. now, where these arguments are articulated. So, which makes it, you know, makes it a very touchy and very difficult kind of situation to deal with.
Colin, Virginia, can we make the whole thing a bit shorter now? Because we really, I think, really over the time. Yeah, Colin?
I'm not really sure that I'm capable of this anymore. But it just struck me the Benjaminian thing and the question of the ruin. One of the images that came to mind was Benjamin's spatializing of time and history in that image of the piling up, I think, in the pieces of history.
Andrew's
nervous thing. But the thing that was concerning me is that if one wants to call it this, and probably one doesn't, the totalizing impulse, or the redemptive impulse, or the impulse to make whole out of the fragment, is there in Benjamin, is it not, in allegory itself as a process, even though he sees history as a ruin, and he's obsessed with the fragment, and he's also obsessed with accumulation, But there's a redemptive component.
The making whole component, through allegory.
The making whole component.
Yeah, which seems contradictory.
Well, yeah. I have a query about it.
Pardon?
I have a query in my own mind.
Yeah.
I'm puzzled by it.
Yeah.
And it was just an observation about that, because yeah. It didn't kind of square.
Well, I don't think, I think you're right, the observation is correct, it doesn't square. That's why, I mean, of course he does not say that redemption is just ahead of us. But there is a way in which, I mean, it goes back to the, you know, to the discussion of memory. I'm getting, losing it too now in the head. But there is a notion that in even, you know, these montage acts of memory, the way he describes them, for instance, in the theses, the tiger's leap into the past, which is sort of a kind of, you know, funny metaphor at that point, or almost orientalist kind of metaphor that he uses there, that there is a kind of moment of redemption in that very leap, in that very kind of constellation of the past moment with the present moment. And that I can take as a, you know, productive approach for historical, critical historical work. But it's still the notion of redemption that, you know, worries me.
If somebody is willing to drop a question, I'd be grateful, but if you urgently need to, Virginia?
Yes, just very as briefly as I can. I think to try and intervene in an optimistic way, I'd be very interested in what you think of one particular public art work, because I think in a sense, the talking about of the monumental has been very much an issue in public art history, is how to make public art non-monumental.
Right.
And that's why I was very interested in what you said about Christo. I think there's a discussion to be had there, but and I think I absolutely agree with you about Baudrillard, and I think Hacker put his finger on it when he asked if there's no more reality, there's nothing to change, you know, when Hacker was very critical about Baudrillard. And I'd like to bring in a piece by Hacker, a piece by Rashid Amin, as two examples, and the last piece, i.e. that there are pieces that can reenact the Holocaust, I mean, reenact the memory of the Holocaust through pieces that demand an intervention from the public or incite an intervention by provocation, which then leads to a public debate. So I'm just saying the piece by Hacker in Graz, in Austria, with the flag, I don't know if you know that piece, but in which he reenacted the covering of a monument.
The covering of a monument, yeah.
That it was then burnt, the flag was burnt, the old Nazi flag by the public at the time. A piece by Rashid Arin in Birmingham, where he actually did, and that's the whole area which I think enters into the monumental, the billboard work.
The billboards, yeah.
Where he addressed the public in the room, and that was set by. And then the piece that this is the one that interests me to know your reaction, of Jochen Gerb, the monument in a public mouth in Hamburg, where he had a tower, which was a tower in the name, which he'd inscribed with his wife, his name, against racism. And he invited the public to come and join, if you like, sign against racism, and that slowly it would disappear into the ground and it would become a plaque. And what happened, perhaps inevitably, tragically, was the racist slogans and graffiti, anti-Semitic and anti-foreigner in every way. And this became a tremendous embarrassment to the city council, and they were decided to hurry up the burying of the monument.
Yeah.
What do you think of those kind of, or even an artist in a less public space like Boltanski, who did monuments for the diaspora in a rather grandiose way, and is now, has recently reduced that to pile that clothes that people can help themselves to?
Well, I think these are extraordinarily, these are very important and often, you know, sometimes successful, sometimes aesthetically not so successful. I think the Gerz, some of these things work conceptually better than aesthetically. I mean, as, you know, as sculpture or, you know, aesthetic space. But I think they are successful in precisely in the way in which they raise public debates. But of course, that's the side of the monumental on which my talk was playing in a certain way, namely the monument as, you know, a site for memory, and not the monumental that I criticized primarily, which is the traditional monumental in architecture as sort of powerfully overwhelming the spectator. But, you know, I think even there, the tradition of the, you know, smaller kind of public space monument is, of course, being, I think, successfully criticized by those artists. What will remain of that in the long run, and how much these monuments, these counter-monuments, will then be remembered is another question. But maybe, you know, remembrance is not their goal. I mean, in the Getz, in the case of the Getz, it's, of course, specifically not, because the monument is no longer visible, it has disappeared.
I think we all agree that Andreas Huysen is really a most wonderful presentation, and the very fact that it has induced this kind of a discussion is most attentive and most precise discussion that one can expect in a large audience like this. You all join me in thanking Andreas.
Well, thank you.